call the House Special Committee on Energy to order. Time is 3:05. Members present are Representative Johansson, Co-Chair Edgman, myself, Representative Millet, and Representative Tuck. On today's agenda, we will be hearing from our friend Dave Sandcliffe on the biomass project that they have going. And then after at 4:00, we'll be taking back up House Bill 182, which is the Gretzky legislation. So with that, it's so good to have you back in the Capitol. And just for the record, just put your name down and start with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dave Sandcliffe, and I'm here on behalf of the Tok Gateway School District, as well as the Tok Chamber of Commerce, where I serve there as Vice President. It's a real honor to be here, and I want to thank the members for all the hard work they're doing on the energy issues in the state. These are big questions, especially for those of us who live outside the grid and in the rural and bush areas of Alaska. I was lucky enough to be present in this very room when the Tanana Valley State Forest was created some 22 years ago. Betty Fahrenkamp, who was then the ranking senator out of the Fairbanks area, created the Tanana Valley Forest. And at that time, there were a lot of promises made to the legislature that this forest would be set aside for utilization of the resource. And the intentions were good, but the forest has not been as utilized as it could be, because quite frankly, we haven't had the market for the resource values. That all changed a few short years ago when we had a major fire in the Tok area, and the community was forced to develop a safety action plan. I was part of the, with the chamber, part of that group. And at that time, we had a new forester in our midst. He is behind me. His name is Jeff Hermans. And we started clearing what we called scrub trees, black spruce, non-commercial type of trees that grow clear to the ground and cause the spread of forest fires more quickly than any other interior fuel. We call it hazardous fuel. And Jeff created a place next to the Department of Forestry, a big gravel pit, and we were so surprised to see how fast that gravel pit filled up with wood from people bringing it in around their houses. And I asked Jeff, I said, what are you going to do with that wood? He says, well, we're going to torch it. And when the conditions get right, of course, that puts a lot of pollution into the air. And he says, it is amazing how much wood is here. And I said, what else could we do with it? And he says, well, in the lower 48 and other places in the world, they chip it and they heat their schools and public buildings and their homes with it. And I said, well, why aren't we doing that? And he says, because we don't have a chipper. And now comes the time that I really appreciate, because so many times as policymakers, you hear so many pleas and negative comments. I'm here today to thank the legislature profusely for the vision that they showed in obtaining a chipper for the community of Tok. That chipper will produce 50 tons of fuel that look just like this in the bags in front of you, 50 tons of fuel per hour. Each ton of that fuel is equal to a cord of wood. Imagine a machine that can grind up trees and produce an equivalent value of 50 cords of wood per hour. Now, that still doesn't mean much unless you burn wood, but if you live in Anchorage, what 50 cords of wood means is, for each cord of wood, 100 gallons of fuel oil. So now multiply 50 times 100 gallons. In 1 hour, that chipper produces the BTU equivalent of 5,000 gallons of number one fuel oil. In 6 days, using nothing but trash wood around our community, we ground up enough wood to completely heat our school for an entire year. We have now cleared defensible space thanks to our forester and the Division of Forestry, who's used absolutely no state funding in terms of an appropriation, just their internal budget, to come out and clear a defensible space around our public school, which is the most valuable state building in our community. By clearing just around the school, they created another year's worth of fuel for the school. Now for the really exciting news. AEA approved, and we will be the first school in the state of Alaska to switch off fuel oil and burn exclusively wood chips that come from hazardous fuel fuel that costs the state of Alaska $10,000 an acre to fight if it burns is worth $9,000 an acre as a fuel source. So now we have gone from a negative 10 to a positive 9, and we have a $19,000 per acre value to the state of Alaska because you saw the vision in providing a chipper for Tok Alaska. The school project has been let. Yukon Construction is the primary contractor, and that boiler will be in place hopefully this year. That's the schedule. The fuel oil boiler stays right in place. The new boiler comes in and hooks right into the existing heating system, which is a hot water system in the school. And now we will be using wood that threatened to burn our community down and was a negative for the state of Alaska in our school system. And what's even more exciting is we have 3,000 more acres of this hazardous fuel to be recovered and used. And sitting here in the audience today with us, and you will hear from him, is Mr. Thomas Deerfield from the first private utility in the state who's seriously looking at converting their fuel oil-fired generation facility to a chip-fired generation facility. When that happens, the $3 million they've been writing a check to Crowley for will now go directly into our little economy in Tok Alaska. We will have at least 12 to 15 long-term, permanent, year-round jobs created because of this fuel. The most important thing is when we start converting our schools and our state buildings, just like Sea Alaska is doing now, to using biomass, we create a market for the private sector to go out and provide fuel. All the money that the state writes check after check after check, and you appropriate millions and millions of dollars for energy costs all over rural Alaska, it doesn't stay in the community. It leaves that community and leaves our state. Now, when we convert to biomass, we create a market which will allow pellets like this and they're in your cup and briquettes like this to be produced for residential use, and at the same time the community benefits from the long-term jobs, and all of the money that's been leaving the community now stays over and rolls over in the community. Many of you are from Anchorage, and nothing is more important to the Anchorage economy than money flowing through it. 95% of the money spent in rural Alaska rolls back through the Anchorage economy. 95% of the money spent in Anchorage never sees the rural economy. That's not your fault or anybody's fault. That's just an economic fact of life, the way our state is set up. For the first time in the state's history, we actually have an opportunity to develop a natural resource product that grows back, that needs to be cut, that the foresters need to remove to better manage forests, and every village can plug into at some economic level to sustain an economy in rural Alaska. When we can ship cordwood from Ketchikan to Bethel and still compete with fuel oil, you know that we can send pellets and chips down the Kuskokwim and Yukon rivers to the coast. Now, a lot of villages aren't going to be technically equipped to chip or even produce a secondary product, but they can barge whole logs down the rivers and avoid the disasters that a barge loaded with fuel oil would present if it spilled. They can go down to a common collection point, let's say Tanana, where that they could then be converted into chips, briquettes, or pellets, which would go downriver to the communities that have no woody biomass near the coast, and back upriver in a form of repayment to the villages that ship them down the raw materials. I can't tell you how important it is to the kids in Tok Alaska to be able to look out a window to see a tree and understand that the lights that are on and the heat in their building comes from an energy source they see growing every day. Within the economic loop of biomass, you have got foresters, college-educated kids, you've got truckers, you've got loggers, you've got boiler keepers, and you've got fuel distributors, all contained in a very small economy. If we want cheaper energy and you cannot have a sound environment, without a sound economy in rural Alaska, we have to have a way to lower energy costs. And people have asked, well, how competitive is biomass with number one fuel oil, which in the interior is all you can burn because of our cold temperatures? The break-even point is about $1.20. If we had fuel oil, $1.20, that'd be about the break-even point, economically speaking. And the reason is every acre of biomass in the interior, on average around Tope, contains 70 tons. Every acre, 70 tons, which is equal to 70 cords, each cord equal to 100 gallons of fuel oil, and it grows back. It's zero carbon. It's eligible for all kinds of carbon credits that we know are headed our way from the federal side. So now, when you look at the economy and you look at the possibilities, you see if we match for $1.20 fuel oil does, there are a few jobs in our community related with that industry, but they're not the same type of jobs that are related with the wood industry. So now if you take the residual benefits of internal income coming in from the people that produce energy back into the community, long-term year-round jobs, removal of hazardous fuel, and every acre we remove saves the state up to $10,000 if we have to fight the fire, and that's a conservative figure. Now, when you come down to a dollar-to-dollar social economic benefit, you're at a dollar a gallon. And when will rural Alaska ever see fuel at a dollar a gallon again? That's kind of the short sell for us. I want to thank the Division of Forestry on the record, because they have put a lot of time and effort into advancing the possibility of a real biomass conversion. Tok is a model that can be scaled to fit anywhere in the state. I want to thank all of you as policymakers. The Gateway School is looking at adding a power head to their biomass heating system. We'll save $80,000 a year on fuel oil if we just do heat. We'll save another $170,000 a year if we do power. And we can sell the excess power back to the local utility company. And they have agreed, and the school has agreed, that if a power head is put in place, the utility will oversee how that's done with all the switching and so forth, so that there's no danger to anyone working on the grid system. The defensible space in Tok, even without any state funding, our forester there has mobilized people to go out to the older, the elders and the older citizen in the community to cut the trees around their driveways and their house, because if we have a fire, and we will have at some point, half of Tok, one side is burned, the other side hasn't burned in 100 years, we're going to lose some people if they don't have a way to get out of their homes into a safe place. Thanks to the Division of Forestry, our school is now a safe gathering point for people to come. And if we have an independent power head there, even though the community and all state and federal services would lose communication if the grid is lost, we'd still have communications at the school. Now, in closing, I will say that I've lived in Anchorage and Fairbanks, and out of 23 years of service here in Juneau, I've lived 4 years of my life in Juneau, Alaska. And I can tell you, as a resident of Tok, in the coldest place in the North American continent, we've seen 83 below zero. I can tell you that you feel mighty frightened when the power goes off for an hour or more at 50 below. And I asked the utility how long it would take them to get an emergency generator in from somewhere else if we lost power at those temperatures. It would take a minimum of 24 hours to get power restored. That would be an absolutely unmitigated disaster. There would be some people who would die. Their cars wouldn't start. They'd have no way to get to a safe place, and there would be no heat on anywhere at all. And that's no different than any other small community that has become so reliant on a fuel whose price cycles go like this, and to watch all the money the state's spending and all the money for their benefit to leave their community is really something we no longer have to do. And we're proud to be leading the way. I'm going to have Jeff step forward and give you a presentation, talk a little bit more about the fuel here. If you come away from the meeting with anything from my end of it, I would say thank you again very much. And whatever you can do to encourage the state facilities to start using biomass energy and wood energy to create the markets we need to jumpstart this industry. I would encourage you to do so. I was originally raised in Vermont, which is the most socially and environmentally sensitive state in the Union now. And Bennington College, Goddard College, Middlebury College, and between 45 and 50 schools in Vermont now are all burning wood chips for heat and in one case, power. And the environmental community has embraced this method for one simple reason. It's zero carbon, and where we used to burn them in stoves and create a lot of smoke and pollution, this biomass, when it burns at 2,600 degrees and these new eco-burners, produces cleaner air than fossil fuel, less particulate matter, zero carbon, as clean as propane, and it's all local energy. And Jeff's got the pictures to prove the point. This is the first pellets ever made in Alaska. They're made right down the road from where I live, a little community called Dry Creek. And Dry Creek borrowed the chipper, well, they actually rented and took the chipper out on a lease basis from Tok. They ground up all their slab wood. They took their slab wood and made chips out of them. They put them in their eco burner, heated a huge kiln, dried all their wood, took the shavings off their wood, created the pellets, and now Tok and that community are burning pellets, no more wood boilers, no more smoke, no more pollution, and all their fuel comes from right off the earth in the proximity of their homes. That's the complete economic circle. That's a small model now, and with your vision can become a much greater one. So, Jeff, are you ready?
Fritz, okay. Yep, thanks.
Thanks, Dave. And I don't know if we have any questions for you, Dave, but we'll call you back up if we do, and let the record reflect that Representative Peterson has joined us.
No, okay.
And if you just put your name on the record for us. Thanks, Dave.
Good afternoon. My name is Chris Mache. I'm the Director of the Division of Forestry and the State Forester. And I want to say good afternoon, and thanks for the opportunity to speak to you here. My comments are going to be fairly brief because I want to get to Jeff's PowerPoint and give him plenty of time, but Thomas, Jeff, and are going to talk about specifics and demonstrate some specific projects at Tok. I'm going to give you a little bit of a statewide perspective because this biomass program actually does fit very well in a number of statewide applications. You have a handout that's titled the Alaska Wood Energy Development Task Group, and this is a little bit of a historical document. It goes back to 2004 when we first formed this group. You can see the members of that group, many federal and state agencies were participants. But this was when we were first really starting to encourage wood energy develop here in the state. There's a number of different scales wood energy can be developed. If you look at the back of that handout, actually you have a color handout, I believe, with the same pictures. You'll see a couple of garn boilers, and these garn boilers are just fancy big wood stoves with a water jacket around it. And the water jacket is where the heat is stored. The wood is combusted in these units at a very high temperature, maybe once or twice a day, so you get a very clean burn because of that, and so you have very low emissions. The heat is energy is stored in the water, and that's circulated out through district heating loops or to provide hot water for washeterias or whatever purpose the community decides they want to use it for. The picture on the left are two boilers in Tanana, Alaska, on the Yukon River, right at the confluence of the Tanana, and the other two are boilers that are out at Kaseloff and Kenai Peninsula. There are several other boilers installed statewide. It's kind of one step up from a residential system. This is the first step up to a bigger system that can be used in a more commercial sense. The information that the rest of the presenters are going to talk about steps it up one step further. When you get into wood chips, that's a bigger public facility, a wood chip burner. Actually, the first one that's been installed in the state was Craig. But Dave is right, the first one that's going to be using hazardous fuel material will be the Tok project. So it'll be the second wood chip burner, but the first one using material that comes off hazardous fuel treatments. The Craig school uses waste material from the sawmill that's at Klawock. So the sawdust and chips come from that mill to run that burner. So at any rate, a little history. There's a lot of different scales this works at, from your home to even a coal utility. You can mix pellets and chips in with coal. 10 to 20%. You could do that right today up at the University of Alaska or any of the coal-fired facilities that are in the state. So there's many different scales this potentially works at. A community can pick the scale that they're comfortable with and then proceed accordingly. I also wanted to stress that there's a very strong relationship with AEA. You guys have really stepped up the plate in funding their alternative energy program, and 13 projects have been funded to date that are woody biomass projects. And the Division of Forestry is very involved with helping to assure that we have a sustainable supply of wood for those projects. So forest inventory, forest management is a very important part of the overall program to make sure if someone invests in a pellet mill, which is currently, there's a new one being built in Fairbanks that'll do 60,000 dry tons of pellets a year, that they have a sustainable source of wood for that facility. So it's the first new wood products facility Interior Alaska has actually ever had built. It's about a $6 to $7 million investment by a private company, and we're very excited about the opportunities that's going to bring the Interior. That'll complement some of the other mills that are already in existence, and really the only other mill is the one that's at Dry Creek right now. The other important aspect of that is having a good transparent process in how we permit and do our timber sale program so that the public supports these kind of operations. We have to have that social license to practice forestry, and when people see a local benefit, a local fuel that's really benefiting their community, they're very supportive of these programs and the forest management that goes along with that. The last relationship I want to point out, and Jeff will get into this in his talk, is the relationship in the Interior in particular, where we have hazardous fuels and we have frequent fires. We have a very large need to do what we call hazard fuel treatments in and around communities that have community wildfire protection plans in place. The community develops this plan. It takes the highest risk areas of the community, churches, communities, buildings, high density residential development, and we do fuel treatments around those areas to try and reduce the risk of fire when you do have fire in a community. And unfortunately, the question isn't if you're going to have fire. We will have fire in these ecosystems because it's an ecosystem that is designed to burn. Often the fire from within a community can be the most dangerous, and Jeff will demonstrate that when he talks about the Red Fox fire that was in Tok. So there's a real important tie between hazardous fuel treatments and these community plans and the opportunity to use this material in these bioenergy facilities. And so I'm going to turn it over to Jeff. We'll all be here later for questions if you have questions, or we can entertain some now if you do.
We have some questions, Representative Peck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just checking to see, I know that there's fire hazards in the area and so forth, but how many acres do you have access to be able to make the wood chip products and pellets? And how readily replenishable is that?
Yeah, that's one of the big questions. Is the fuel source sustainable? And that's one of the big questions the public will often ask. So that's a very good question. And Jeff will get into some real details on their specific projects in Tok to demonstrate that. But in general, this pellet mill that's under construction in Fairbanks would use about a third of our annual allowable cut in the Fairbanks working circle. So it depends on the scale that you're talking about. By and large, most of the projects that have moved forward are space heating projects, so they're for heating buildings. Several hundred acres is what it takes for most of those projects. So it's well within the allowable cuts. We have the Tanana Valley State Forest in the Interior. It's got 1.8 million acres of lands dedicated for forest management use. They're multiple use lands, so many other activities occur in addition. But we have plenty of the resource available to actually meet the needs, especially for a smaller community in the rural areas. Generally, you have a native corporation that has the primary ownership around these rural communities, and then state lands are tiered off of that, or regional corporation lands. A community of, say, 500 could easily meet its needs on a sustainable basis with wood energy for their energy needs. They'll get into some more details on that, too, in the presentation. Other questions?
Sure.
Representative Johansson.
Thank you. So you're telling me that the allowable sale that the state can do under their statutes per year, you have a limit, is that correct?
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Johansson. We have a limit based on the forest management plans that are written that establish what's called an annual allowable harvest level or annual allowable cut. So over a 10-year period, we have to stay within a sustained yield cut for whatever given lands we have. We have several different authorities to offer sales, including a couple authorities that would allow us to do long-term contracts. One of those is called the 123 statute, based on what its number is, but it's called the value-added sales. It allows us to do contracts for up to 10 years in length, 10 million feet a year, to a company that proposes to do value-added processing. And in regulation, there's actually a list of things that are considered value-added. It's things like, planed wood, pellets, things of those natures are considered high value-added. Someone has to invest in the product and add value to it to qualify for that. The other authority we have is called the Schnabel Act. It was originally for Haynes, and there's a couple criteria that have to be met. High-level unemployment, which is enumerated in the statute, and I want to say it's 12%. It's a pretty high hurdle. So the urban areas of the state generally would not make that, but most all the rural areas would reach that hurdle point. For example, Taupe would fall well within that unemployment level. And we can do up to 20-year contracts for a resource. So we do have authorities to do longer-term contracts if that's the way we need to proceed for someone to make investment in these kind of facilities.
Madam Chair,
follow up. Representative Johansson.
Do these programs, they all have to fit within the allowable sale quantity per year, per 10-year? The 123 and the Schnabel, they all have to fit inside this tent?
Yeah, through the chair to the representative, yes, they do. They have to fall within that annual sale quality, mm-hmm. Quantity. We can't actually offer more than what the sustained yield calculations are for given geographic areas. And we have different, for the Haynes State Forest, we have an allowable cut calculated there. For Southern Southeast, we have cuts calculated for state lands. So as you move around the state, different geographic areas have cuts that are actually calculated for that area.
Representative Johansson.
Yeah, sorry, I get so excited. Our Resources Committee has been doing nothing but oil and gas. We never talk about anything that has to do with forestry or anything else for that matter. It's kind of frustrating, but I appreciate the leeway here. Under the Murkowski administration, the ASQ was accelerated, I believe, and I'm not sure if that's happened up in the Tok area, but at least in Southeast it has, and now we're forced to have a smaller cut so the 10-year average works out. Is that similar in Tok, or was that specifically to Southeast to spur the what's left of the industry down here? But is that affecting Tok as well?
No, through the chair's representative. No, that you're right. That was a special program in Southern Southeast that we called the Bridge Timber Program. And we managed those cuts on a 10-year rolling average. And we had for many years not met our annual cut in Southeast, so we essentially had interest in the bank. So we were able to accelerate that program for about a four-year period until we caught up to what the average would be, which is about, unfortunately, only 8.4 million feet a year in Southern Southeast, not very much. And so we caught up to that level, so now we've cut it back to what the average amount is. And we offer in Southern Southeast, everything we offer, we sell. It's all processed locally. That's not the situation in the interior. We've never come even close to offering our full allowable cut in interior Alaska. We offer less than 10% of the allowable cut in interior Alaska, and Tok is probably even a lower percentage than that. So there is a very large amount of surplus material that we can devote to this kind of endeavor.
And one final question, Madam
Chair. Representative Johansson.
Is the legal environment in the Tok area similar to the Southeast area, where most everything offered, at least federally, I'm not sure about state offerings, are they litigated, or is it just, it's just, no offense, not as easy a target, I guess?
Yeah, through the co-chair's representative. State sales, I'm happy to say we've only had litigation on state sales about five or six times in the history of the program. And I'm very happy to say, I'm going to knock on some wood, we have prevailed in every one of those cases. We have a very sound process. If we follow our process, dot our I's, cross our T's, it's been upheld in court six different times. So it's much unlike the federal process, which is a very difficult process to manage, mainly because of the NEPA laws that they have to jump through, and there's a lot of places they can be tripped up if they don't really be careful in how they proceed. So the state system's a much streamlined system. It still has plenty of place for public participation, public transparency, but not at all like the federal system. So, and in Tok, to answer your question specifically, that I can think of, we've never had any challenges to the sales that have been offered in Tope or anywhere in the Tope Big Delta area.
Can I be a smart aleck for just a second?
Representative Hansen.
I want you to confirm the comments made by Mr. Stancliffe. These things grow back, right?
They do grow back.
Thank you.
And pretty vigorously.
Renewable resource.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along those same lines, do they grow back on their own or these are replanted?
Through the chairs, Representative Peterson. It depends on the species that we're talking about. In Tope, as you'll see in some of the pictures, it's white spruce and black spruce that are the hazardous fuels that are being removed. We have aspen that aggressively comes in after that removal on a lot of the sites there. Aspen's a species that spruits from routes or roots very aggressively, and so it'll do that on its own. We don't need to do anything else to encourage that. Different parts of the state up in the interior, we do planting. If we want to bring spruce back to the site, it's better to actually do some planting of spruce. Otherwise, we get a hardwood type first, either birch or aspen, or sometimes cottonwood. But we do need to plant in some circumstances. Most of the forests we're talking about in this presentation are actually considered non-commercial forests. They're not ones that we would normally manage for a saw timber program for a sawmill or someone that was producing a higher order product. These are lands that traditionally we've considered non-commercial lands because of the small diameters. And this is the first real opportunity we've had to start managing these for a commercial use. It also happens to be the types that are also very hazardous from this fire aspect. And so it really is a nice marriage between a real serious problem from a hazardous fuel standpoint and a way to also help communities meet their energy needs.
Follow-up, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So typically, say, in the Tope area, what would be the grow-back period? How long would it take for the forest to come back so that it could be harvested again?
Yeah, through the chairs to the representative. If it's a hazard fuel treatment, our objective there is to convert it from a conifer type to a hardwood type because hardwoods are less flammable and gives us a better and safer place for our firefighters to work from. Those types we would like to maintain every 15 to 20 years. We'd like to re-harvest that, use it, and keep it in that hardwood type. If you were going to allow it to convert all the way back to a conifer type, a white spruce type, you'd be on the order of magnitude of probably 100. Our rotation's actually about 60 to 120 years on the state forest, and it depends on the quality of the site, the growing conditions, so soils, aspect, a number of other issues. But on average, the rotation is an 80-year rotation on the state forest as a whole.
Thank you.
Representative Mitchman.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. It's just really interesting to observe how well-kept the secret has been, if you would call it a secret. And I guess my question to you would be, is using biomass wood as a primary fuel source. Where do you see that in Alaska in 5 to 10 years in terms of other communities using it, in terms of its potential, underutilized as it may be today?
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair, it's got a lot of potential, like I said when I started out, in a number of different communities, particularly in the interior part of the state where fuel oil is the primary heating product. The first and lowest fruit is for space heating purposes, so either larger public buildings, things as large as a prison, hospital, those are common types of public facilities in other parts of the country that use biomass heat. Schools is one of the obvious ones in most of our communities. So right now with 13 projects funded through the AEA program, those are going to be what we refer to almost as demonstration projects. We're going to help demonstrate this technology. It's off-the-shelf kind of technology. It's not new technology. It's used in other parts of the country and other parts of the world already and has been for many years. Once we demonstrate the effectiveness, the cost savings, and the benefits, I think it's going to really catch on in a lot of communities. Fairbanks, as you might know, has had some air quality problems with wood smoke because many people a few years ago when the oil prices really spiked installed a lot of new wood stoves, a lot of central boilers or outdoor wood boilers. All these things before you here are burned under forced drafts. They're densified, they're dry, So they meet all the EPA standards for particulate and emissions. So in Fairbanks in particular, we may see a conversion to wood pellet stoves as opposed to round wood stoves in order to meet some of the air quality standards. So they have urban applications. They have rural applications. Really, it's there's really not much of a limit right now. It can be co-fired, like I said. We've done studies with all the coal utilities. They can mix this material in to co-fire with coal, and there's actually some interest in that up at UAF to do something like that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And Jeff is up next. So.
Jeff is up next.
I don't know if I can turn maybe one of those lights off to help see the
sure.
slides better. Do I have to sit right here, or can I stand up?
Yeah, okay. Just put your name on the record
okay.
for...
My name is Jeff Hermans, and I'm the area forester for the Division of Forestry in the state of Alaska at Tok. And this is a lot of slides, but a lot of them are just a few seconds, so I'm going to try okay. and crank through here. So
no problem.
The whole area up in Tok, and it was kind of going back to what you were asking about as far as length of rotation and that kind of stuff. Like most of interior Alaska, we're part of a fire ecosystem up there. I mean, all of the red has burned since 1935.
Wow.
I mean, that's pretty dramatic. The stuff in the green, and that's right where we live in Tok, that's the only part that really hasn't burned right there. So that part in the green right there is the really high volume dense spruce that hasn't burned. And so you can see why we're so frightened, you know, because history proves that the chances are we're going to burn. So 1990 Tok River fire, I was on I just coming out of college, was on a type 2 fire crew up there. One of the biggest fires in state history as far as not acres or that kind of thing, but dollar-wise and amount of personnel on the fire and stuff. The state of Alaska spent over $30 million on that fire. They evacuated town twice. It came right up to the east side of town, and it was just by the grace of God and a shift in the wind at the last moment that Tok didn't burn down. So then we've had many fires over the years around Tok and in the Tok area, but the second significant fire, and on a lot different scale though, but it kind of illustrates the real issues that we have in Tok, was called the 2001 Red Fox Fire. It was 120 acres, and it burned 120 acres in less than 2 hours, and it cost about $1.2 million. And so you can see right there with the starter location, you can see how it's got that long shape to it. That means it was a wind-driven fire. And if you start looking at all the fuels that surround there and the potential for what the fire had, you know, anybody can look at that logically and see that we escaped disaster by a very narrow margin right there. There's another picture of it. See how the fire was spotting out away from the main fire right there? That shows how explosive the fuels are. The fire is coming up in a big column and it's spotting way out away from the main firehead. And so you can see the potential that we have for a disaster up there and people getting, like what happened in Australia last year, getting burned over. That right there was one of the folks that they did good. They had cleared enough trees around their home with that rock pad, and they survived it. It was very close, to say the least. That one didn't want to work for some reason here. So if you take a look right there in the gutter, right just left of the door right there, you can see where the gutter actually melted. It got so warm.
Mm-hmm.
And these people removed not near enough fuel from around their homes, and it cost them their home. And so that potential exists throughout a lot of Alaska, and especially in the Tok area. There's a lot of homes that need to remove the fuels. So since the state took over fire suppression from the BLM in the last 25 years, the state has spent $50 million fighting fire in the Tok area. That's not preparedness for the fires. That's just when the flames are around your ears and things are burning in a reactive way. I mean, that's a lot of money. So,
Jeff, I had the opportunity to be up in Tok last summer, and mm-hmm. I saw the helicopter on the pad there.
That's right.
What was it per hour to keep the helicopter in service?
Our contract with that specific helicopter for 8 weeks of availability is $500,000. And that's just to sit on the pad. That's not to turn a rotor.
Tremendous cost.
Yeah, huge cost.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, so it's additional money if they spin the rotor?
Oh, absolutely.
Wow.
That's just for the availability of the helicopter. Yep. So you can see the intense energy coming off that fire right there. That is the forest that we have throughout much of Alaska right there. So, you know, in the last 20 years, you know, you look at that fire that we had in 1990 and you look at where we're at now and what's changed. Well, the forest has continued to grow in the last 20 years. We've got a lot more people living in those fuels. So actually our situation in the main Tok area is at least as bad as where we were, if not worse today than what we were before, with the exception of the fuels that were burned up in those fires. We don't have to worry about that. So in the state, we have the state fire management plan that kind of tells us how we're going to go out and fight fire. And of course, we're not going to let fire happen around our homes and stuff. So in critical fire protection areas like this, we're not going to let fire happen. So the forests continue to grow year after year. So what do you do with the fuels? You know, the threat from a fire is going to continue to get worse and worse. I mean, all that forest is going to continue to grow. So it's a real issue that we have statewide with this.
So do you, I have a question for you.
Sure.
So do you, when you go in and do your forest management plan, do you first remove the trees from around the homes? You know, like in South Central, we have a lot of beetle kill, so they come in and the forestry will come through and help
sure.
clear for safe.
Well, and that's the whole issue. And in a few slides, it'll kind of show you how, since 1990, we've only received a little over $300,000 in fuel reduction monies. And that's all been from the federal government. We haven't had any state funding for that. And so basically it's had to be just on people's own merits to try and make themselves safe. Mm-hmm. You know, and so the fire management options, they don't have anything to do with actually removing the fuel. It's just how we're going to attack the fire.
Okay.
So when I got to Tok, it's like we need to get the community together and we need to come up with a plan. You know, because are we going to be in the same situation 20 years from now where we are now? And so I got the community endless meetings and got the community engaged, and we came up with a plan. And this is what Chris is referring to. We need to have these kind of plans for all the communities throughout the state that are surrounded by forest. And basically, this community kind of details, you know, what we're going to do to kind of address our issues. I mean, that's what it looked like before the Red Fox fire. And so you can see those homes around there and the issues that we had, it's quite obvious with the fuels that we have a significant problem. So right there is a typical road that we have in Tok. How would you like to drive out that road if that were on fire? That right there is an average of 40-foot clearing on our roads in Tok. I don't know if you heard about the disasters in Australia last year, people getting killed in the wildfires over there. But essentially what happens is you're in your house, the fire's coming, and if you've made your house defensible, you can stay there and do what's called the burnover. You sit there and you pray and you wait for the fire to come over. But a lot of people, with the smoke and the sound of these fires is like a jet engine coming at you. And so at the last moment, you go out, you jump in your rig, and you go down the road. Well, you can imagine what happens. You know, and this is what gives Chris and I gray hair in the summertime when we get high fire danger. So the slides just don't want to work here. That's the roads that our firefighters have to go down to try and rescue people to get them out away from their homes. That's a death trap. For our firefighters, that's a death trap. I mean, obviously, they're not going to get out of that with a wildfire.
So, can I jump in?
Edmund?
If I remember from the tour that I took with Dave last summer, and there's a machine, isn't there, with a mechanical arm that can actually reach there and sort of...
Absolutely.
You can thin out some
exactly, and I'll show you in just a few slides here. Yeah. Yep, you're absolutely right. You know, another shot up the Taylor Highway in 2004, you see the energy coming off of that. So we talk about that defensible zone that you need around your home. You really need, in the toke area with the fuels that we have, you really need 100 foot around your home to guarantee the survival of your home. You need 100 foot. And so I'll show you in a few more slides, but our forests are so thick up there, and we've went out and we've been doing a research study. We have over 10,000 trees per acre in a lot of areas up there. 10,000 trees per acre, you know. So if you're in the middle and you need to clear out a 100 foot around your home, that's an acre you need to clear. Well, even you know, as healthy as I am, running a chainsaw all day long, I mean, it would be a huge job for me, and I know how to do it. Most people, there's no way they can do it, you know. So right there, that fire, it was a burn barrel, got away from them. If they had to clear it out away from their home, you could see how it would have gotten into that stand, and it would have been gone. It would have been up and going. You know, that right there, that would be extremely iffy whether we could save that cabin or not. And that's probably an average of how a lot of homes are in the interior and throughout a lot of Alaska right there. You know, you can imagine that those trees on fire from looking from those other slides there. So in Tok, when we came up with our community wildfire protection plan, it's like, you know, how big an issue do we have here? And so we got and we mapped out the fuels, and we have 38,000 acres in that stand. Remember that green, that little green dot that I showed you earlier? That's it right there, that red. That's 38,000 acres right there. Every one of those little dots on there are fires that we've had where our firefighters with the state of Alaska went out and put those out. And so any one of those little fires could have been the fire that could have taken out that entire stand. The thing to really note in that slide right there is that there is no break in it. You know, you don't see any big line, or you don't see any kind of break throughout that stand. And so you know, how I showed you earlier how the fire spots way out in front of it, you know, that's what gives us a nightmare right there. I mean, there's 1,500 people living within that. So, again, 2004, you know, there's your contiguous fuels. You can imagine trying to stop that fire. I mean, how big a fuel break do you need to stop that fire? So... This is basically it. You know, the whole idea is to work from the inside out. You know, don't be cute. Use your money as wisely as you can. Solid science. Be really straight up with the public. And that's what I was in Tok. You know, I told the public, I said, listen, we have a huge issue here. We're not going to be able to deal with it unless we really go after this in a big way. You know, we can't go about it cute, you know. So... There's two reasons why people don't make their home safe. One is they don't have the dollars to do it, or two, physically they can't do it. You know, like I said, I mean, it'd be a huge thing for me to go try and do it. And so it's not that people don't realize there's a problem, and it's not like, but most people can't afford to do it, you know. So this is the plan that we came up with. This is the... And this is was with in consultation with our fire experts around. You can see how we're trying to break up that stand. We're trying to create lines throughout that stand to give our firefighters some lines and some anchor points to work off of. And so inside those little tiny yellow lines, that adds up to 3,300 acres, which that's a lot of ground. You guys know the 3,300 acres. I mean, that's a lot of ground. But out of 38,000 acres, that's only 8% of that entire high volume spruce. You know, so I mean, 3,300 acres, that's a huge problem we got, huge project. So you were asking about, stand conversion, and that's it right there. That happens naturally. That happens, that aspen root system, that it's called coppice, it's in the ground, and sometimes it's dormant for up to 100 years. And then a fire comes through, takes the spruce out, up comes the aspen again. I mean, that's the natural cycle up there. That's what we start out with. And the spruce, if you look real hard through there, you can actually see spruce already starting to come up underneath that aspen. Eventually, the spruce would overtake the aspen, shade out the aspen, and then you have a climax stand that's ready to burn again. You know, a lightning strike comes through, boom, it burns again. And so, and it goes back to the annual allowable cut again. Most of our stands don't get to be much over 100 years, not because they wouldn't continue to grow, but because nature takes them out with a lightning strike. So, we said, where are we going to spend the money first? And the obvious thing was the Tok School, like what Dave said. Another thing was is we had a communication tower right behind forestry that was a communication tower for the troopers, forestry, Department of Transportation, and it was completely, it had fuel clear up and underneath of this thing. I mean, if a fire were to take out that tower, we would lose all emergency communications. I mean, and we just got that accomplished just this winter. Senior citizens, I mean, you can imagine seniors trying to get out of their homes in an evacuation, in an emergency, And then again, to create these fuel breaks, to try and help to give a, safe place for our firefighters to work from. So this is the school project right there on the right side. See how thick those fuels were around the school right there? This was just 2 years ago. And you can see the tower, the DOT tower on the left right there. I don't know if you can see that right there, the little tower signal. And that's the Division of Forestry on top and the DOT on the bottom. So this is all on state land. And so, this is just it. So if you were a firefighter right there, what kind of break do you think that you would like to have, to fight fire from? One of our effective tools that we have, it's called a backfire or a burnout. And so the fire's coming at you. If you have a good anchor point, a good line to work from, you basically go out and you light off of that line and you hope, you burn that out and you try and pull that fire back into the oncoming fire. And it's a very effective tool. And we actually go through scenarios in Tok where we would light off of the Alaska Highway and burn out one side of the town to save the other side of town. Nightmare scenarios. See that little spot fire that she's putting out right there? Look how far out from the main fire that is right there. And so, again, people go, well, geez, why are you doing 300 feet? How would you like to be within 300 feet of that wall of flame? Pretty scary stuff. But look at the energy coming off of that right there. So how dangerous is Tok and how much energy is there? That's the typical stand right there in Tok. And that's what I was talking about, that 10,000 stems per acre right there. Now look at this slide. Same slide right there. If you look at that and then you look at that, same type of tree, same thing. So we set out to find out how much energy is in the forest out there. So we went out middle of winter, and I said, this is ridiculous that we don't know how much energy is in our forest. We went out and went about figuring out how much energy is out there. So basically what we ended up finding out was that there's a lot more energy in our forest than what we thought there was. And it's not too hard to figure out how much energy is out there, but it's really labor intensive. So what did we find out? We did these 100th acre plots, and we, like I said, we're getting anywhere from 6,000 clear up to 10,000 trees per acre on a lot of the. We thought that there was maybe 10, 15, 20 tons per acre out there in the forest. And what we found out so far is that the lowest we've had so far is 33 tons per acre, and it's went all the way up to 187 tons per acre. Big numbers. A lot more fuel in our forest than what we thought there was. So if you work the math real quick, 60 tons per acre is about the average we've come up with so far. 2,000 pounds 4,500 BTU per pound is these chips right here in front of you. A 1 pound of that is 4,500 BTU. And so if you do the math right there, that's 548 million BTU per acre is what we've come up with in Tok. And so if you multiply that times the 39,000 acres, that's 21 trillion BTU in that Tok stand. That's a lot of energy. And, you know, we've always known our wildfires are, you know, they're hot. I mean, there's a lot of energy there, but we've never calculated just how much energy is in them, you know. So fuel oil equivalent, you know, 1 gallon, 139,000 BTU. And so if you work through the numbers right there, there's 3,900 gallons of fuel oil equivalent in Tok per acre. So 39,000 acres times that 3,900 gallons per acre, that's 153 million gallons fuel oil equivalent in Tok. These are all backed up by, you know, laboratory tests, and I mean these are sound numbers. You know, we're not making this up. I mean, you know, so yeah, you know, 3.6 million barrels of fuel oil. So you know, you look at that same Tok stand and fuel oil equivalent, trying to get people to think about the energy in our forest in a different way. So throw some values at it, $2 a gallon, that's it's 307 million in fuel oil equivalent. And biomass at $60 a ton for biomass, that'd be $140 million. The grant proposals with A and everything, that's what we used, is the $60 a ton. And that was paying back, that had like a 15-year payback with the Tok School. So how many acres of hazardous fuels need to be removed? At least 500 acres on private property, and it's actually probably three times that much. So if you go through there, we would like to do 3,300 acres, or about 8% of the total fuel load. You talked about how do we go through and remove these fuels. Like I said, we're not... You know, we're doing a very sound method of removing the fuels, but we're trying to do it as efficiently as we can. And these mechanical harvesters like that, they can remove sometimes up to 2 acres a day. And we're doing it for about $1,000 to $1,200 per acre. And so if you work through the numbers and you look at the 60 tons per acre going back, we're harvesting it for about $15 a ton, which is actually very good for numbers for doing biomass projects. And this is in a stand that's considered non-commercial. When we're doing our annual allowable cut calculations, we don't consider these stands even in those calculations. That stand right there, if you look at it, there's not a tree in there that's bigger than 6 inches. And so that stand right there is considered a non-commercial stand. So we can do it manually. And in the past, this is what, you know, this is what we did in the past. That's what it cost. So if we were to go out like what we had before we thought about biomass and all this and said, you know, we need to remove these 3,300 acres, that's the amount of money we'd have to come up with to remove that 3,300 acres. There is no, there's no way we're going to get that kind of money in Tok to remove that 3,300 acres. Since the 1990 Tok River fire that cost over $30 million, we've only ever received $320,000 in federal funding to remove hazardous fuels. That's all come through the Department of Interior, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and our partnership with them. The state of Alaska has never funded a single dollar for fuel reduction anywhere in the state. The outlook for fuel reduction when we're competing with California and their billion-dollar fires is not very good. So we decided we wanted to make the school the centerpiece of our project. So we approached the school and we said, you know, we really need to remove 50 acres of fuel from around the school. And when I told the superintendent that, you know, his eyes got real big, you know. But after a lot of education, walking around the woods and everything, we got him educated that for the safety of the school, we needed to get this done. So You know, we got the kids out. I've spent a huge amount of time in the classroom, taking them out in the woods and everything. We've made huge progress educating people on our forest. And this is absolutely doable. So $50,000 is what we spent to remove the 50 acres. And we have enough fuel to heat that school, just from the fuel we removed around it, to heat the school for an entire year, which normally they would have spent about $130,000 to heat that school for a year. We broke it up into units. I worked with the school. Some areas we thinned, some areas we clear cut because they wanted to expand a ball field. Some areas we cleared because they wanted to put a road in, you know, so it was a real collaborative thing with the school. We took them out, we showed them, you know, what happens with the Red Fox fire right there, you know, and trying to get the kids to go back home and tell their parents, listen, we need to remove this fuel from around our homes. So that's the way it looked before. That's the only road in and out of the Tok school right there. So you can imagine that with a wall of flame. The Tok school is our evacuation site and our emergency response place in Tok, and it wasn't safe. People say, well, you can't use equipment around schools, you know, and everything else. We use that Feller Buncher and we use the skidder. My expertise and my forte is logging engineering and stuff, and we can do really good work with equipment. So see how small that wood is? I mean, most people wouldn't consider any of the trees even cordwood trees. I mean, would you consider that a firewood tree? You know? Most people wouldn't even bother with that to put that in a cordwood stove. You know, the whole idea, though, is to pick up that entire bundle and chip that entire thing in one swoop. You don't handle it piece by piece when you chip it. But the point of this is that normally conventional equipment like that wouldn't even consider harvesting that small of tree with that kind of equipment. But we proved that it is feasible. That's what it looked like after we got through doing some hand thinning right there. I think that looks beautiful. So that's the decks that we currently have around the Tok school right now. That's all fuel ready to burn in the Tok school boiler. That right there is another, you know, see that big deck of wood right there? And that's just from the thinning of that little stand right over there. You know, before that would have all been piled and burned. So can you imagine going in and harvesting 50 acres around a school? I mean, I didn't get a single phone call. The only phone calls that I got in Tok were people going, can I go over there and go cut firewood out of those decks? it's because of all the work that we did, though, educating people why we're doing this project. I mean, people really do get it. So the whole thing is we're trying to turn this whole thing from the huge liability that the state has right now into an asset. So this is the machine right there that the state funded through a CIP for the Tok community. That machine cost about $300,000, but you can see how we're not feeding tree by tree. Literally, you can grab and big grapplefuls at a time and put through that. That's what we did with all the hazardous fuel before we got the chipper right there. We just set a match to it. Literally, we burned thousands and thousands of dollars worth of fuel. We just put a match to it because we didn't have anything. There's no market. There's no outlet. There's nothing. There's no use for it, you know. So everybody said, well, you can't do hazardous fuels into biofuels. It just doesn't work. It's not the right kind of thing. And we're like, really? Why? You know? Absolutely, absolutely, it does make excellent fuel.
Hopefully, that's not your first call.
What's that? Dave talked about the pit earlier that we used to burn, and the picture before with all the kids where we're standing there looking at the. That's it right there. That material, that pit fills up with fuel 3 times a year, every year, with people clearing out stuff on their property and bringing it in. It's a very simple process. One pass through that machine and that material can go right into the school boiler. This is actually at the school. We did a demonstration project, and that's the hockey rink we're blowing chips into right there. So you can see it's called guts, feathers, and all. It's whole tree processing. You don't have to limb them. It's a bunch of trees at once. That's it right there. It's ready to go straight into the boiler and to heat the school. So we marched all the kids out there in the classrooms, and we had them all hold up a big pile of this. We love trees. Try to get kids to think about trees in a whole different light, you know. But now they understand those trees are actually going to be heating their school. So remember, $5.7 million to remove that the old way. If we were to use that same fuel reduction for biofuels, this is what it would be worth. That 3,300 acres would be worth $11 million at the $60 per ton. That's quite the change around there. So $17 million switch from a liability to an asset. That's the difference right there.
That's awesome.
So, you know, I'm not saying that we're ever going to get $140 million out of that, but there is potential there for that. So there is the TOPE school that we worked around. This is kind of showing you that the funded project, the AEA funded right now. This is the way it gets delivered, just like that, and those chips right in front of you in the little bag, that's it right there. They get dumped into a big bin. This is all automated. It automatically gets augured in. Come on. Go to the next slide. No, there we go. So it went into the big bin. So now it's automatically coming out, and it's being augured onto this conveyor belt. And that's just the raw fuel. That's the raw fuel that's sitting in front of you right there. So I mean, it's, you know, you're not up there handling all this fuel, you know, with a shovel. I mean, this is all proven technology. This is in schools throughout Montana, throughout Vermont, back east in Massachusetts. I mean, back east has been doing this for a lot of years. How many years they've been doing it, Thomas, for, you know, 20 years, you know, so. Again, it's completely automated. There's no one standing there watching the whole thing, and so it's extremely dependable. You can't have a school that doesn't have a dependable system. And it's basically the same boiler. It's not the same boiler, but it's a wood boiler that's been around for over 100 years. The only difference is it's like a fuel injection for a boiler. There's a computer sitting there constantly monitoring the fuel in the air. And that's what gets you that combustion of over 2,000 degrees and the efficiency out of it. So, that's the burn chamber where it's over 2,000 degrees in there. And there is no smoke that comes out of these things. That's the old-fashioned steam piston engine with an electrical generator on it. That's been around for, you know, 100 years, and that's what the TOPE school plans to put on the steam boiler. So right there, that's actually a boiler in operation in Montana, and you can't see any smoke coming out the stack right there. And so a lot of people's concerns are smoke coming out of these, and there just isn't any. So right there, the TOPE school, over the 30 years life, if you combine the savings in heating cost and electricity, over the 30 years, it'll be a net savings of $7.8 million. So the value of the TOPE school project, you know, to the local community, these are dollars that's going to be staying locally now. And so you can see, I mean, it just adds up. And then looking at it from a fuel reduction point of view again, at the $1,200 per acre for the fuel reduction, that'd be about $36,000 annually. That's $1 million over the 30-year life of the project. And that's in fuel reduction. So the direct cost of a fire in the urban interface, it's well over $10,000 an acre. That's actually, they've come out with studies recently that by the time you figure in all the other economics of fires, it far exceeds, there's a multiplying factor of about 3 in there. So you know, the state of Alaska needs to get serious about fuel reduction. We need to say fuel reduction needs to be happening around the state. It's a good investment. So there's never been any funding for fuel reduction throughout the state. I mean, it's a really good investment. You know, $1,000 of fuel reduction versus $10,000 for an urban interface fire. So if we started burning, you know, wood in our state facilities, that would create the demand for all these products right here. And anyway, you can read through these slides later. I know you guys are short on time here, but you know, I haven't got mad. You know, I just we're just trying to get everybody to think about trees in a whole different light. So we can, you know, we can continue to do like what we've done in the past and let the forest fires, you know, take their run and not be proactive about how we manage our forest and use the energy wisely and densified products and in chips and stuff. You know, or we could grind it up and heat, you know, heat schools, heat public buildings and everything. You know, there's the burn chamber again. You know, that's so we can, you know, we can go out and harvest it and control it how we burn, and we can realize the benefit from that for, you know, for our society. You know, again, this summer, we're going to be sweating it. So hopefully this won't be the summer that Tok burns down. So
that's the plume from your wood burner?
There's no plume from our wood burner. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, no, thank you so much. It's so good to see things that are positive that are happening throughout the state of Alaska. It just seems it makes complete sense, and I'm so glad you're enthusiastic about it, because it really, you know, it just starts in one place, and you know, much like fire, just spreads, right?
Yeah, it does.
So hopefully we can keep moving it through. Is there questions from the committee?
I have a couple questions.
From Sam Johansson.
You're part of the state?
I am the area forester for the state of Alaska at Tok, and so I'm like the federal equivalent of a district ranger. So
you basically work for the forester?
That is correct.
Okay. Well, I have a question for the forester, but I can wait until we're done with this gentleman.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The storage, because you don't want that wood to get wet and soiled and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I know you guys have the hockey rink, but you guys have like a covered storage, or do you not have problems with it getting too wet out there?
The current design for the boiler for the Tok school is that they'll be able to basically have 2 months' supply of fuel inside the building with the boiler at any one time. And so basically when they need more fuel, they'll go out and they'll chip it into bands and they'll deliver it right inside the building. But they're also, that's a great question, because they're also planning to build an outside storage with a big covered top, like a pole building, you know, to store chips under as well. But our climate in Tok is so dry up there, you know, that the moisture on the chips isn't really an issue. We only get about 10 inches of rain a year in Tok.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Great presentation.
No, that was thank you very much. That was a great, great presentation. I'm glad that Dave had the fortitude to come to the Energy Committee and tell us the great things that are happening in Tok, and the cost savings is phenomenal, not to mention the fire-wise safety that's happening in that community. You know, we've all seen the dramatic footage of fires and that you're doing, you know, killing two birds with one stone is pretty amazing.
Madam Co-Chair,
and
maybe this is the time where I make the pitch to committee members, if not individually, to us as a whole, as a committee, that we ought to go out and see this ourselves and maybe get a chance to actually see it in action at some point, who knows, even during session. But if not through Tok as well as through nearby Dry Creek, and Dave had the opportunity to take me up there, and to see Dry Creek up close is absolutely amazing, to see what they're doing up there in terms of a small scale, almost starting up an economy designed around you know, harvesting wood.
Mm-hmm.
And the self-sustainability aspect of the community itself is pretty amazing. And yeah, that is one well-kept secret unto itself. And then to see what the potential as a toke, and then to magnify that, as the state forester was saying a moment ago, on the potential statewide, I think it really is definitely a fuel source that is underutilized and has a great, great amount of potential. So I really appreciate the presentation today.
And I really look forward to you coming out to Tok. I mean, because when you see it firsthand, Dorothea's been out to Tok, and when you see it firsthand, a whole tree go through that chipper, and out the other side comes fuel. It's just, it is incredible. So,
any other questions? Thank you so much for your time.
I really
appreciate you making the trip to Juneau to let us in on how you guys are energizing Tok.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We'll take a brief at ease.
Madam, I'm sorry. Can I ask the forester two quick questions?
Sure.
I know we need to get to the next bill, but
no,
I
no
just
worries.
Have two things I need to ask. And
I just want to put your name on the record for
Yep. For the record, my name is Chris Mache, state forester.
Thanks. I don't want to take up a lot of the committee's time, but I just have two real quick questions. On this conclusion slides, it has two slides of we need the state of Alaska to declare this, we need this, we need this, we need this. We being you, being the state of Alaska, is there some bottleneck within the administration that you can't just come out with a bill that would do this, or a policy, or I'm not quite sure. There's a disconnect here in my mind that we, the forestry division, is telling us that the state needs to do something, but you are the state, so.
Correct.
I'm missing something.
Through the co-chairs, representative. The funding that we've received for hazard fuel mitigation projects, as Jeff alluded to, has all been federal funding, either through earmark process or through RF funds. We actually competed for about $7 million of competitive funding. This is not the formula-driven stuff that most of the agencies have gotten through the RF projects, but we had to come up with a project and apply for it and compete against all 50 other states. We were successful in getting about $6.5 million that will actually go toward hazard fuel mitigation projects around the state. The state hasn't invested any general fund money in hazard fuel mitigation. We've had to essentially get it from federal sources or other places. So it is something that just recently we are a lot more interested in doing. And obviously you've seen some of the benefits that there is some potential to use this for a bioenergy source. And so we fully intend through the normal budget process to ask for some additional support for hazard fuel mitigation work. Some of the policy things that are taking place through the climate change sub-cabinet task force, the CWPPs are going to be one of the recommendations, I believe, that will come through, I hope, all the way through the governor's office level. We've recommended that CWPPs be completed for each community that's in a fire-prone area of the state. Right now, there's probably about maybe 60 CWPPs completed in the state, but that's just a very small fraction of the amount that need to be done. And then that's the blueprint for how these hazard fuel mitigation projects would go forward in each of these communities. So the next challenge is figuring out how to fund those. Some of this may help do that.
Just a quick follow-up. So,
Representative Jansen.
Some of these things in the conclusion you're internally working on now. You're not necessarily asking anybody to do anything about it. You're just letting us know what you're trying to get through your internal processes. Now, as far as the money, requesting state funding for fuel reduction work, that's a big bag, and it says Alaska Pellet Company on there.
Yep.
And as I was watching the presentation, they kept saying, you know, we are doing this, we are clearing all of this forest. Mm-hmm. Can't you just say, is there a private company? Go out and get all the wood you want, turn it into pellets, and make money out of it. I mean, why is it, are you guys contracting out? Are we spending state money on this clearing?
Mm-hmm.
Or can't you just say, here's 100 acres, go at it, turn it into pellets and make some money, and we're just going to let you do it?
Sure. Through the co-chairs, it's still enough of a developing market that it's not matured to the point we can do that. There's an incubation period for all this stuff, and usually it takes investment by someone to do that. And that's was the point of that earlier paper that we handed out. We started back in 2004 starting to try and develop interest in the private sector to do some of this. That interest is starting to develop, so we can potentially do a sale where we would have a pellet company or another densified fuel manufacturer go out, purchase timber sales from us, and actually do that type of work. The problem has been in the past, as Jeff was saying, most of this material is considered non-commercial. We're starting to demonstrate that may not be the case. But it takes a mind shift in the industry and in the people that have been in the industry to see that maybe there's an opportunity here to do something different than what conventional wisdom in the past has said was not feasible. So there's a bit of an education, chicken and egg thing going on. We're still in the development phases of trying to get some of these industries off the ground, developing a market for this material. And if there's enough of a market, then the private sector will start stepping up to the plate.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick editorial. These are the kind of things that have been lacking in the last couple of years in this legislature, is talking about things like this. I mean, we have got our heads so far up oil and gas, so we don't have 5 minutes to talk about anything else, and it's frustrating. I think this is great. I mean, I would love to let that company go out there, get 100 acres, and get all the wood they want, and turn it into a product and sell it and make some money and put people to work.
Yep.
Madam Co-Chair,
Representative Edgman?
Let me throw something, too, because I agree with that.
Yeah.
No, the Rural Energy Conference in Fairbanks coming up end of next month, mm-hmm. is, I guess, maybe to Jeff or to Dave, is this presentation we provided at this conference? Are you part of that conference?
They've asked me to give a presentation at that conference on the supply end of it for about 15 minutes or so.
But I definitely want, all seriousness, to associate myself with the comments of the Vice Chair. I think that's it's incredible that this has not been more developed. And, you know, the cost of power a couple years ago in Tok and in Dillingham and elsewhere have been, mm-hmm. you know, where they are today. So it's no secret that we've been in dire straits for some time.
No, I appreciate the comments. It's something that we've realized for many years being foresters, we're kind of focused on this kind of stuff, but it takes a while to get traction with some of these ideas. And when you don't have funds to invest, it's hard when you're also the venture capitalist that has to raise the money to make some of this happen. So,
Chris, you need to scream louder.
Yeah, I guess so.
Representative Johansson is right. We do seem to focus on the oil and gas sector as our only resource, and it's nice to see that outside of oil and gas, we have got a vast quantity of fuel that not only saves some of our communities and can heat some of our communities and get schools off of fuel oil, which I just think is a phenomenal program. And I'm going to be your new number one fan and start talking about this, because this application that I see here in Tok, there's so many other places around the state of Alaska that are energy anemic that could be doing the exact same thing that you're doing, giving the right direction and the right funds and your enthusiasm.
Yes.
I think it's just a great testament of the things that are actually working and going right in our state that we don't hear enough about. Mm-hmm. So enough gloom and doom. Let's talk about how to prevent forest fires and how to use that as a fuel supply to energize our communities.
Yeah.
Madam Chair?
Dave?
You're not going to have a chance to hear him because your time pressed. Thomas Deerfield, private utility company, in Tok. They're getting ready to change over and start consuming biomass. He'll have a presentation maybe privately to talk with some of you about. I'm sorry we didn't get him up, but that completes that circle that we're talking about, where forestry on a 20-year long-term contract turns them loose to turn wood into electrical energy as well as heat. So I just wanted to let you know that he is here and he'll be getting around to meet with some of you. So
thanks, and I imagine that every single one of the Energy Committee members will make time to meet with you. So with that, thank you very much.
Yep.
and
you're welcome.
Thanks for all your enthusiasm and the good work you do.
We appreciate your time. Thank you.
We'll take a brief at ease. Just for the record, Representative Ramirez did join us quite some time ago, and now Representative Dahlstrom has joined us also. And at this time, we're here to take back up House Bill 182, and where we left off last time is we had an objection to adopting the CS, and I think that objection was by Representative Ramirez. And at this time, Representative Ramirez, would you like to?
I'd like to withdraw my objection.
Thank you, and I will withdraw my motion to adopt the CS 26-GH1041/E Bailey, dated 3/18/10, and I will move to adopt CS 26-GH1041/7 Chenoweth Bailey, dated 3/24/10.
Object for discussion purposes.
Thank you. So the work draft that we have before us, all the members should have on their as a working document. This is a document that was drafted by the Senate, and what we did is we got authorization just to take their CS and make it our House bill for our working document. So with that, we have Mr. Strandberg from AEA to come and make some opening remarks, and then we're going to have a walkthrough from the Department of Law, and we will just go until 5 o'clock and see how far we get, and then continue with this next week under bills previously heard. So with that, Mr. Strandberg, if you'd like to come up.
Madam Chairs, / S, is that correct?
/ S, yes. Do you have a copy?
I do. You said 7, so I
would. Oh, did I?
Just want to make sure
yeah.
I didn't have
26-GH1041 /S.
He told me to say.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Strandberg. If you just put your name on the record.
Madam Co-Chair, my name is Jim Strandberg. I am a project manager with the Alaska Energy Authority, representing the administration in support of this bill. Oops.
Representing I'm sorry, Mr. Strandberg, you said the administration was in support of this bill?
I think what I meant to say was we are here to speak regarding this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Strandberg.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
That's all we wanted.
I'm working hard for that glass of wine.
Before or after. That's a little joke we had in the office.
I'm here today with Mr. Brian Bjorkqvist. I have brief comments given the hour, but I did want to come back with you. When we left the subject last week, there had been a number of what I would characterize as very pertinent questions on the legislation from a policy standpoint. We have thought about that that proceeding and have written down the questions and appreciate the committee's concerns about this bill. There was one question concerning the solvency of the utilities, and I did make a promise to come back with work papers which would describe the work that our financial analyst, Seattle Northwest, had done regarding the financial status of the companies. And I have the Appendix B from the Rail Belt Integrated Resource Plan, which specifically, from a financial analyst standpoint, looked at the financial condition of the utilities. I have copies of that, which I'd certainly be pleased to provide and leave with the committee.
That would be great, Mr. Strandberg. We'll have our committee aide get those to all the members and make sure that it's available for the public also.
And I wouldn't, unless it's your desire to go back into that subject, I wouldn't do that given the fact that I think everybody would like to hear from Mr. Bjorkqvist a scintillating conversation concerning section-by-section analysis of the bill for you.
Thank you. And just real quick for the committee, there was a, with the drafting from Ledge Legal, there was a draft. There was some comments made by some advisory notes from the legal services that accompanied the Senate version. You should have it as a memorandum from legal services, and it's addressed to Senator Lisa McGuire from Jack Chenoweth. Those are still some what Ledge Legal feels are some outstanding issues on the bill, and also accompanying it are some amendments from the administration. An additional 2 pages of amendments to the CS that we have as a working document in front of us, so everybody has those in your committee packet. So as we go through, I'll give you the weekend to digest the CS, digest the amendments, and look at the outstanding issues that Mr. Bjorkqvist is going to go over with us from Ledge Legal. So with that, Mr. Strandberg, did you want to continue?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. The administration is very pleased with this grassroots effort that is really coming forth from the Rail Belt Utilities to create a new corporation which really responds to the energy future. And certainly we were collaborative partners in the process, the governor's office as well as the Alaska Energy Authority. Our agency in a lot of cases served as neutral ground to assist the utilities really to come together, and I want to stress that this is in many ways a first as our state matures to get all six of the utilities at the three levels, their board level, their CEO level, and indeed at their technical level, to the table together to craft a solution. And I just wanted to emphasize that we regard this as a first step. We are not done. It is, in many ways, one of the more positive responses that we've seen from the rail belt industry. Indeed, they are private, not-for-profit companies. They own the infrastructure, and they are member-owned, of course, by, you know, as half the state's population. So in many ways, I just wanted to characterize that in concert with the previous presentation, this is a very positive action that the utilities have taken and have come before you. And they are, as we speak, presenting in Senate Resources. My sincere hope is that you'll consider the bill in those lights.
Mr. Sternberg, I think Co-Chair Edgman has a question for you at that point.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Jim, I wanted to ask about, you know, the stops and starts involved with this whole journey have been too many to count, for sure. But where I last left off, and it was prior to the presentation that the utilities are making to the Senate committee, apparently in real time as we speak, where I left off was earlier in the day, learning that one of the utilities had basically said, with the committee substitute that is not before this committee, that they, with the changes to the agreement that the six utilities had apparently had all agreed to, that one of the utilities had was preparing to back away. And so that would mean five utilities, not the entire six. I'm talking about Homer Electric. Can you speak to that, if you would, please?
To the extent I am able. The utility task force by teleconference met at 1:30 today. And I did talk with the task force leader, Rebecca Logan. And my understanding is that that matter was going to be addressed in testimony by Homer Electric at the Senate Resources. That was the plan, and we'll just have to see if there is some clarity that can be derived from their testimony. I believe that's happening now, or has happened.
And Madam Co-Chair, not to belabor the point, but it seems somewhat self-evident that if all six utilities aren't in agreement, then that puts this whole concept somewhat on shaky grounds, if you will. And I guess my question specifically, Mr. Sternberg, would be, what happens if one utility does pull out at this stage of the game? I wouldn't characterize this as us being in the 11th hour of the session, but clearly we're in the 10th, maybe moving the 11th here fairly shortly. What might that mean to a concept that a lot of work has gone into up until this point?
We would similarly be concerned with that.
Okay. Thank you. And for those members, I don't know if everybody received that letter from HE. Jeff's running up to grab a copy of, so we can all have the same information. But we did receive that letter. I think it was yesterday, after the Senate adopted the CS that we adopted, that HEA was now not in support of this legislation, and that they were withdrawing as a member. But I think you're right. I think at this point in time, there's been some negotiations, and HEA may rescind its letter or one of those things. But I'll just, for the committee's information, I'll make sure that letter is available to each one of you, so you can understand why HEA had some of the issues that it had. So thank you.
So in light of the hour, it's 4:45. Unless there are questions from you for me, I would propose to turn the cudgel over to Mr. Bjorkqvist. The gavel.
The microphone. Thank you, Mr. Sternberg. Is there any questions? And we'll be able to call you back up if there are questions in the next 15
Absolutely.
Minutes. Any members have a Mr. Sternberg? Okay, thanks. With that.
Okay. And we do have the PowerPoint from last week available as well.
Thank you. You'd just like to state your name and your affiliation and begin a walkthrough of the CS.
Thank you. For the record, I am Brian Bjorkquist. I'm an senior assistant attorney general with the state of Alaska. My primary client agencies have been the Alaska Energy Authority and the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority for the past approximately 13 years. With the time limits, I will not be able to get through the entire CS, but I'll just get a start. And please just let me know when the time is up and we can continue this at a future time.
And Brian, just for the committee, when you have something that wasn't in the original bill that we had last year, can you just kind of point to those major changes? Because there are some big changes in the bill that 182 as we received it from the governor last year, as opposed to this CS. It's a much different bill. So maybe we could just
certainly
highlight some
Madam
of those big co-chair. Changes.
Okay. And I think I can do that with just a brief overview of what this legislation does and would create, as opposed to the past one from a bigger picture. I might not be able to point out every detail throughout. What this legislation would create is a new form of entity, an energy and transmission corporation. What that is modeled after is a generation and transmission cooperative. That is basically a type of entity where public utilities get together and they form this G&T cooperative and use that as a vehicle for providing for their generation and transmission needs. They collectively plan for, develop, and implement their generation and transmission needs. The public utilities remain distribution utilities. They provide electricity to their retail customers. So that is basically what this type of entity is. The original bill created one specific corporation. This bill instead creates a statutory scheme, an energy and transmission corporation, and within it provides the authorization for the Greater Rail Belt Energy and Transmission Company Corporation to be formed. The bill provides that four or more electric utilities that are municipal utilities or cooperative utilities that form together to acquire or operate a project from the Alaska Energy Authority, part of the former energy program for Alaska, plus get together to plan for their interconnected system, can form a energy and transmission corporation if it's first approved by the legislature. And this legislation, section 13 of the work draft, is the section that provides the authorization, the legislative authority for the specific corporation to be formed. Now, the question might be, why was that transformation? And there are a couple of answers to that. Legislative legal had a memorandum last week which questioned whether there was a constitutional problem, local and special legislation. The shift to this type of a general law provision for this type of a company versus a specific type of corporation helps to address that question. Now, there still could be some constitutional issues with that. They were addressed in a memo that dealt with that issue also. That was, I believe, has been provided to the committee, and if not, we can make it available later. But this shift addresses, at least in part, that issue. The other main reason is the original bill was modeled after CFAP, which is a specific quasi-public corporation that is established in statute. Through the course of the task force and the utilities getting together and describing what kind of a corporation they want, there's been a subtle shift. There's a shift from something that's a little bit more of a quasi-public, providing a public benefit type of corporation, into something that's a little bit more private. A subtle shift, not a dramatic shift, but a subtle shift. The utilities wanted more freedom and flexibility as to how they would operate within a Gretzky corporation. They wanted the ability and flexibility to be able to develop on a utility level their own projects, rather than there being an expectation that this new corporation would be the sole provider of generation and transmission type services. They wanted some flexibility in that regard. Part of that is from an understandable position. We're starting from a position where there is nothing, basically. And for the utilities to sign on to that type of a corporation having more and more of an expectation that it's going to be providing all requirements at some point is a little bit much on day one. Mr. Strandberg last week spoke of an evolution of the corporation, and that's what this bill really will allow for, more so a little bit more flexibility in year one, and an opportunity for it to form, evolve, and be able to provide the generation and transmission services, prove itself, and then instead of the characterization in the task force was, rather than being forced into an entity by a stick, being drawn into it with a carrot. Have it prove itself, and then the utilities will be more likely to join into it. So what this legislation does is that's the subtle shift. It gives a little bit more freedom to the utilities, but with an expectation that this entity will grow and evolve into something that's going to be providing more for the rail belt. It still provides public services within the rail belt, but there's just been a little bit of a shift from the expectations. Going through the bill, sections 1, 4, and 5, these are the sections that deal with rate regulation by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska and municipalities. Under existing law, both statutes dealing with municipalities and statutes dealing with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, if an entity is not rate regulated by or regulated by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, municipalities have an ability to step in and regulate. What the sections 1 and 4 do is say that when GRETC is not regulated by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, it also will not be regulated by municipalities. And Section 5 provides for the exemption for regulation by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. In the effective date provisions, these provisions would take a place, become effective August 16th, 2015, 5 years into the future, 5 years after the organization of the GRETC Corporation. So there would be 5 years of full regulation by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. 5 years into the future, that's when the exemption from rate regulation would take place. Now, one of the suggested defects or concerns that Legislative Legal raised in yesterday's memo was that there's a possible inconsistency between Section 5 of the bill and what would become the amendment to Section 4250-100 in Sections 7 and 8 of the bill. And the inconsistency is the language in Section 5 would suggest that GRETC will become completely exempt from all regulation, which is not what was intended. But when you look to the amendments to Section 100, it is an exemption from rate regulation. And so the suggestion was to have some language to clarify those and tie the two together. And that's the first proposed amendment to deal with that inconsistency pointed out by Legislative Legal.
Brian, can I stop you for just a second? I have a question on one of the things that we're currently working on within the legislature is third-party gas storage. And I noticed that within the first couple sections, it talks about the GRETC owning fuel storage. And my question to you is, basically, GRETC would still be a third-party storage facility, but it's not regulated under the regulations that we're asking the third-party storage to be under currently that's being legislated. So it would be in contradiction to the third-party storage that we have, you know, making its way through the legislature now, yet this would be an additional third storage group, and they would have no regular RCA oversight on their storage. So I don't know if there is some way to fix that within the bill so the storage, I mean, was that intentional that the storage owned by Gretzky would not be regulated also?
Madam Co-Chair, I believe the language that you're referring to is on page 2, line 15, which deals with exemption from contracts dealing with a variety of things, wholesale contracts between Gretzky and a public utility. In line 15, it says, and related contracts for wheeling, storage, regeneration. That language is language that was used with joint action agencies and also Bradley Lake. It's our belief that that wasn't intended to pick up gas storage, but rather was intended to pick up, for example, water storage or something like that, which would be related to a hydroelectric project. And there's probably some amendments that could be made to make that more clear as we go forward, and we would be happy to work with the committee to identify that. If there are other provisions that deal with fuel supplies, and there may be some references to storage there.
There is
as well
on page 4, line 5, the adequacy of fuel supply, fuel storage, and fuel transportation.
And then there's also a section, I believe it is now numbered 150. I will find it. Excuse me, on page 14, line 15, there is a provision for fuel supplies, and on line 17, at the very end of that, there is also the word storage. And I am not familiar with the other legislation that is working through, but within the bill, there would be an easy way to include that this exemption from RCA regulation either would or would not be covered by that. The amendments to section 100, section 7 and 8, specifically section 8 on page 18, deals with certain components that are related to regulation that would still apply to the corporation. Under 2, for example, joint use and interconnection provisions would still apply. And if there's some specific reference, that might be a place that it could be incorporated. But again, we'd be happy to work with the committee to identify a solution to that. But I don't believe that the intention was focused on deregulating that.
And then on that point, on the point of the interconnection, you also, I noticed that if there is interconnection from an IPP, the interconnection had to conform to the corporation's interconnection guidelines and what their standards were. And so then that also is contradictory in the bill where you say that the interconnection is not regulated based on the standards that the Gretzky would corporation would form, and then on what you just pointed out says that the interconnection would be regulated. So it sets up a position of adversarial roles for an IPP coming in, being determined if they were determined, let's just say the wind farm on Fire Island didn't have adequate interconnection for Gretzky, they don't have any negotiation other than to go to the RCA to complain and to put a start a docket to get interconnection within Gretzky. So I'm a little confused by the interconnection.
Madam Co-Chair, let me just walk through the two because I believe they're not inconsistent with each other, but they work together.
Okay.
The provisions dealing with Gretzky taking a role on interconnection, and there are a couple of places in here that happens. Unfortunately, I can't just point it out right now. I will later when you ask. Those are really sections intended to replace a void. Right now, the reliability standards, interconnection standards in the rail belt, they're half contractual, half voluntarily abided by. The Alaska Intertie Agreement includes provisions dealing with interconnection and some reliability provisions. That agreement is only signed by some of the rail belt utilities, not all of them. And so the ones that have not signed up to it, they're basically voluntarily abide by the provisions as opposed to there being a contract in place for the provision. That contract also is set to terminate next October, the middle of next October. And so at that point, something else needs to be brought into the place. These provisions dealing with Gretzky stepping up for interconnection provisions is intended to be filling that void. So that there is an entity that's going to develop and deal with those interconnection standards. Now, the RCA regulation and requiring joint use and interconnection is intended to be, and I believe it does, is provides that notwithstanding these standards that are set up, if somebody is feels that they're not being treated fairly in the process, the RCA, through its processes, can at the end of the day, compel interconnection to happen. The process is a two-step process. The first step of the process is there's an obligation on the utilities to negotiate with each other, try to negotiate terms and conditions for how that interconnection would work. If the two utilities are unsuccessful in that regard, then they can go to the RCA, and the RCA can open a docket and compel interconnection with the terms and conditions established by the RCA. And while that might look like a cumbersome process, it's actually quicker than if you had just litigation between two parties and tried to have them go through court system as to how to deal with it. You have an entity, the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, who is set up to do this on a regular basis, who can act in a prompt manner. I've been involved with one situation where joint use and interconnection was at issue, and that was with the Alaska Intertie. There's approximately 19 miles that are owned by Matanuska Electric, and they were used as part of the Alaska Intertie under a contract between the Alaska Energy Authority and Matanuska Electric. Matanuska Electric elected to terminate that agreement, and so you had a gap of 19 miles that otherwise, you know, for the Alaska Intertie, it doesn't work very well with a gap. Several of the railroad utilities went through this process. They first tried to negotiate terms and conditions with Matanuska Electric, but that did not work. And ultimately, they went to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska and had a docket open and a hearing, and the RCA was able to issue an order that provided for joint use and interconnection and did so in a manner that there was no disruption. And so they acted in a relatively prompt fashion. But using an existing process can be more valuable than trying to create something new. And so that's what this is attempting to accomplish in this bill.
Okay.
Section 2.
Let's just go to about 5:10. That way we can all be 10 minutes late.
Butler by 5, Madam Chair.
Okay, Butler by 5. Sorry.
I'll just continue, and okay, just let me know when time's up.
Okay.
Section 2 of the bill, it also deals with the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Section 2 is a bill that says power sales agreements between Gretzky and public utilities will not be subject to review or approval by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. And then there's also these other related agreements, and the storage was one of them mentioned earlier. This is a provision that is would apply for as long as there's long-term debt associated with a power project from which the power sales agreement was associated. This provision is now applicable to Bradley Lake and also to Swan Lake and Lake Ta'i, two hydroelectric projects that were formerly part of the Four Dam Pool and now in the Joint Action Agency in Southeast. The purpose of this provision is to provide an assurance of and protection for financing. if a power sales agreement, which is the primary source of repayment, were subject to regulatory review, there is some concern for financing that there may not be a ready source of repayment. And so that's what this provision fundamentally was aimed at. It's comparable to what is currently in place with both the Bradley Lake project and the two remaining Four Dam Pool projects in the Joint Action Agency in Southeast. There are some differences, though, also. With those other projects, they're limited to specific projects. With the GRETSI, it's forward-looking and future-looking and would be to new projects that would be developed, as an example. Section 3, and going back to Section 2, similar to 1, 4, and 5, this is a provision that would not take effect until 2015. Section 3 is a section that deals with a component of rate setting. This is identical to the provision in rate setting that's going to become effective in 2015. This provision will be repealed, and the identical language will become effective in a rate setting section. And rather than deal with it here in isolation, I promise you I'll deal with it when we get to that section on rate setting, because it's better to see it flow through that process. And then I'll just remind you that at least for the first 5 years, these provisions will be applicable. Next, on page 3, section 6, now we're getting into the general law dealing with an energy and transmission corporation.
You know, Brian, this might be the perfect place to stop. We're at we just finished section 6, so we're at chapter 50, basically line 15 on page 3.
That is correct.
Okay. Why don't we take a break there and pick that back up on Tuesday, possibly, and...
Tuesday? That's almost the end of session. Oh, is that on the record? I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Before we adjourn, is there any... questions on the first 2.5 pages? Representative Tech?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to point out that the title has really drastically changed from version E, version S, down to version A. But I'll be looking at things a little bit closer, trying to figure out how this is evolving and where it's actually going to. But I just wanted to point that out, that there is major changes taking place.
Thank you, Representative Tech, and that will be a nice weekend project for us all to compare all three documents on our little weekend break. Representative Johansson.
I have a request.
Yes.
Please do not schedule anything that has to do with timber prior to the next GRETSI hearing, because timber makes me angry.
Okay. Representative Edgman.
All the paper in the legislation comes from timber.
Okay, with that, thank you very much. I will adjourn at 5:10.